When you mention cybersecurity, people's eyes roll to the back of the head and they're going, oh, well, that's an IT thing. When in reality, it isn't. It's about keeping your business operational in the modern world.
Hackers managed to get into it and held the business ransom. Guess what? The business couldn't bake bread for 2 weeks, which is like absurd. Surely these guys must know how to bake bread.
That's why cybercrime, if it was a country, would have the third biggest GDP in the world. 2025 damage is going to be around $10 trillion globally from cybercrime.
Before we start this podcast, will you please like, follow, and subscribe to the Right Place podcast right here on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Rudolf and I would also love to connect with you on LinkedIn, so look us up there too. Thank you. Cheers. Welcome to the Right Place podcast. My name is John, and today I'm talking to another John. My guest today is John McLaughlin. He's a cybersecurity pioneer, a global entrepreneur, and someone who's built a practical, no-jargon business that helps keep companies in business. His company is J2 Software, and they're on a mission to stop bad things happening to good businesses. And today we're diving into what that really means, how to stay digitally resilient, and what getting stuff done looks like in 2025. John is also a member of the Lacker Network, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later. Welcome, John. Great to chat to you today.
Fantastic. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome, John. Thanks for your time. John, let's dive right in. You often say that cybersecurity isn't an IT issue, but it's rather a business risk issue. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. One of the problems I always have is when you mention cybersecurity, people's eyes roll to the back of the head and they're going, oh, well, that's an IT thing. When in reality, it isn't. It's about keeping your business operational in the modern world. Long gone are the days where people would go into work and then leave and that would be it. Now we're working all the time from everywhere. So therefore, a cyber or digital security requirement is actually it's vital for the survival of a business.
No, excellent. I love that explanation. And I think it goes hand in hand with everything is related to IT somewhere. You're using software to create your services, your products, to interact with your clients. And all of those different IT software and hardware that you're using comes with their own risks. So you can't avoid IT nowadays. And even we're hearing businesses getting hacked through WhatsApp. What have you seen in the WhatsApp space maybe?
Yeah, I think, leaning back into the previous thing. So sure, technology is there to enable the tools that are used for security, but we've got to address it from the functional areas. So attackers have evolved. They're leveraging AI. They're automating their attacks. And then because so much attention has been placed on the endpoint, for example, a computer will have multiple agents, potentially having people looking at them all the time. So the attackers evolve to move to different channels. So they want to get the victim to either get onto their mobile device, jump onto an iPad, go into a browser, or something else that's outside of the regulation channels. We've seen attacks starting in mail. Over 90% of attacks start via email, and then trying to move them out over that, either to a unprotected public type email like a Yahoo, Gmail, etc., onto WhatsApp, or even into things like LinkedIn or Facebook Messenger, because that way there's less protection there, and there's this false sense of security and figure, well, we're not being targeted here; it must be okay.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you, and I think there's this false sense of security because everyone thinks, no, the IT guys are handling it, but sometimes you need a bit of common sense. And I mean, we've come a long way since the I Love You virus that attacked the world via email in the early 2000s, but people are still getting hit in emails. Why is this? Do we just drop our guard, or we just think the IT guys are handling this? Every email that comes my way is safe and secure.
I think that there's definitely a lot of naivety. A lot of people don't really understand the risk and the implications, and they don't put things down to their thinking as it would be in the real world. Like, for example, if you're walking down a street and there's a building you can't see into it, it's dark, potentially abandoned, and somebody runs out from the alleyway next to it, can't see their face and goes, quickly, come with me. I've got this amazing prize in this building for you. Just follow me down this dark alley and I'll show you exactly what it is. I mean, there's absolutely no way you do that in real life. But when it comes to the digital space, people click, link, stick in their credentials, give away passwords, and that then leads to a major compromise. And it's often not detected because there's no resilience, there's no visibility built into any of the processes. And IT and security are related, but they're different things. And I mean, that's really the criteria here. Digital risk, digital security is so important. And yes, we're in the same field as IT and technology. But that to me is like saying, you know, in the building industry, for example, you know, you have plumbers and you have electricians. So they're both in the building industry, but they're not the same thing. If you want a plug point put into, installed in your home, you're probably not going to ask the plumber. So when it comes to security and ensuring the resilience of your systems and your environment, like IT will help to a point, but you do need experts.
Mm-hmm. No, 100% agree with you. And I mean, every week there seems to be a new report out about the increase in cyber threats and attacks. And even if you're working from home, you're not 100% safe. You might think these attacks just happen in the corporate environment or at the office. I'm at home. My IT is secure. No one's going to find where I am. What are you seeing in that space currently?
Well, the reality is with hybrid working models as they are, and people work from everywhere and all the time. So they're working on mobile devices, they're working on their laptops, they're working on these things. Remember, virtually every single person, the only computer they ever work on is the one that's given to them by work. So that means there's also a whole lot of personal activity that goes on, which is fine. But at the same time, if they're potentially downloading things incorrectly, by mistake or on purpose, the kids are going online and gaming. Are there legitimate gaming sites? What are they downloading? What are they purchasing? What are they looking at? All of these items are all interconnected. And then, of course, you've got the home Wi-Fi setups, which if you ask a lot of people, you're going, well, have you changed the default passwords that came with the device when it was delivered to your house when fiber was installed? Are you still using the exact same password that was given to you by the ISP? There are steps and measures you can take. There are various items that people would look at. But again, it comes down to the fact that most people don't know what to do. Or just too lazy to implement them because it might seem inconvenient. And maybe you need to click on two more things before you can stream Netflix.
No, exactly. And I mean, I'm just thinking about like one-man band, very small teams. They've probably bought a laptop online. The laptop arrives. They connect to a Wi-Fi framework. They don't really have an IT or cybersecurity team in their place. So, and they just assume, look, man, I've got a small business, but it's not just about the size of the business. It's maybe about the size of the clients that you're servicing or the types of information that you're involved in. And especially with LinkedIn, I mean, you can find out exactly who you are, what type of business you are running. And then you can also do some sleuthing around on the internet and you'll be able to find this guy's actually working for some mega clients and maybe he's a weak link into them. And people just don't understand that concept sometimes.
100%. And often, the thing about cyber criminals is that they don't discriminate. They have automated and launch attacks for the most part against absolutely everyone who will fall victim. Once they gain access, they then look for the value. You know, these are businesses. They run like businesses. They do a whole bunch of research. When they get into your environment, if they see you're a one, two, or three-person business, that doesn't bother them. They're going, well, is your data worth making a few grand off or not? And if it's not your data, what they'll then do is target your customers, target your suppliers, using your infrastructure, destroying your reputation in order to launch more attacks, becoming that stepping stone in the attack, or use your infrastructure, your OneDrive, your SharePoint, your items, whatever it is, to host malicious content. Now, if they put malicious code into your and then lead people to click from your infrastructure, you're the one whose reputation gets smashed once someone finds out and there's a loss further down the line.
No, that's quite a hectic example. And I mean, another example that I've heard of recently is a simple bakery that was held for ransom in Scandinavia somewhere, where the hackers had got in, they found all the go-to recipes of this bakery, and the recipes weren't written down. They were on a OneDrive or a Google Drive somewhere, and the hackers managed to get into it and held the business ransom. Guess what? The business couldn't bake bread for 2 weeks, which is like absurd. Surely these guys must know how to bake bread, but they had very specific recipes and measurements and things like that. And their business came to a standstill for 2 weeks and they had to pay the money over. So even like a simple bakery business can be held ransom by these hackers who, like you say, they don't discriminate at all.
Absolutely. I think one of the core pieces is if you look at how you want to monetize any business, you look at the way that you'll get maximum bang for your buck, right? So if you target a business and you can stop the way that they make money, you cripple them and you do leave them absolutely no alternative but to pay the ransom. And this is why we're constantly talking about building resilience. You know, making sure you have backups. A lot of businesses, specifically smaller businesses, owner-run businesses, they figure, oh, well, we use OneDrive, we all use Google Drive, we got Dropbox, whatever it happens to be. So my stuff's backed up. Or we're on 365, we have data retention. I've got version control, we have 30-day retention, so I can roll back without a problem. The thing is, all of these tools are known to all of the attackers. So once they gain access, if you don't know they're there, the attackers don't pounce straight away. They learn, they sit, they read through your data, go through everything. Once they know where everything is, before they launch their attack, the first thing they do is they switch off your data retention policies. They wipe out any shadow copies. They get rid of backups if they're in the same environment. Little things like that, so you cannot recover. They take every step possible to make it that you have to pay them. And you know, that's what resilience is all about. It's the same way as we protect our homes. Like you put in alarm systems and you've got the greatest locks and whatever else it might be. But if you leave everything open, you can't be surprised when you come home and your TV no longer lives in your house.
No, that's an amazing example there, John. And I really think that people need to, I think, catch a wake up here. And you've told me that J2 has built cyber resilience frameworks to help customers understand the threats better. Can you explain how those frameworks work and into how much detail do you actually go?
Well, essentially, what we've done over the years, and I mean, we were doing cybersecurity before it existed. That's the line I like to use because we never used to call it cybersecurity when we launched in 2006. The world's obviously evolved. Compliance laws have changed. Privacy laws have changed. But to help understand, to create understanding, we have a five-pronged cyber resilience framework, which effectively addresses for us, the five key areas of digital risk in a business. These are the users, which is you and I. We're the ones that get tricked. We're the ones that give away our credentials. We're the ones that click on the wrong links. We're the ones that download the legal software. All of these kinds of items that go on, right? So we also touch all other elements of this. The next piece of this is email. So we put controls around email and then also compliance requirements. So things like ensuring business continuity, disaster recovery, having immutable archives so that the data isn't lost. So email is a key part. It's the most widely used application in any business today. We then have machines. So the physical machines, the actual devices we work on. And we put tools in place to things that making sure we have things like multi-factor authentication. We do data encryption and obviously endpoint protection with managed detection. I think that's the key piece where people often fall down or fall flat is they put a piece of kit on, some kind of tool, some shiny, blinky thing with the red light, and mine's cooler than yours, and then leave it and think everything's going to be okay. Without ongoing monitoring, you're going to potentially have lots of trouble. So after machines, the data, the actual physical data, making sure that it's resilient, that if it gets destroyed through one or other reason, including total loss, we still know of businesses that have in-house servers that all their data resides internally, And when it comes to loss, it's not necessarily that it was stolen. There have been incidents, if you look at what happened in Durban a few years ago, various other parts of the world, where buildings essentially get burnt to the ground. So total loss, you must have something offsite. So yeah, so we've gone machines, data, email, users, and then the internet. The superhighway, and ultimately how, you know, that's where we live nowadays. Everything transacts over there, and every business in the modern world, you brought up the bakery, is a digital business. We all work with email. We all work on devices. We have data, and we have people that are at the ends of those. So putting in practical controls and measures to identify, obviously you stop it absolutely as much as possible. But when something happens, when a person makes a mistake, that way identifying immediately and eradicating the threat when it happens is how you stay secure and keep moving forward.
No, 100%, John. And I love there what you mentioned about cyber insurance. I mean, that's become a buzzword as well in this space, because if you get hacked or you lose all of your IP or something like that, or you have business disruption, I mean, we obviously want insurance to step in and kind of level the playing field again. How does J2 Software work with cyber insurance companies? What are you seeing in that industry?
So we work with a number of brokers, and we've got some arrangements in various markets we operate where the actual insurers will provide better premiums based on the fact that people are working and deploying our services. And insurance, again, it's the same thing. We do absolutely everything we can to protect our cars, for example, our homes. But there are things that can happen. They still go beyond that control. But like with any insurance, the key piece is making sure you have that resilience stack in place, because we've seen in the past, unfortunately, where people will fill in their application form, they'll get given their cover, and then when an incident happens, the insurer will go, okay, well, can you show us your latest vulnerability report? And they go, well, what do you mean? He goes, no, but on your application form, it says you do regular vulnerability assessments, so where's the last one? And if you haven't, well, claims repudiated, don't get paid, and away you go. So making sure that you have these controls in place allows you to get insurance at a better rate, and everyone wins. The brokers we work with love it, because they know that their customers, their clients will be paid in the event of an incident, which is because they've got all the controls and evidence backing it up. The insurers love it because the risk is lower of them actually having to pay out. And of course, the customers have the cover, and they're more secure at the same time. So it really is a win-win-win situation.
No, that's excellent, John. And now, John, we obviously can't not talk about AI. And AI is definitely helping all the good guys. It's helping us be more productive. It's helping us come up with funky, cool pictures that we can put all over our social media. But at the same time, it's helping the bad guys get cleverer at hacking systems and infiltrating the workspace. What are you seeing in that space as well?
Yeah, the weaponization of AI is what a lot of the terminology is. They've got to come up with some cool phrase for all of it. You know, phishing is becoming more effective because, one of the key telling factors around phishing attacks in history was the fact that it was badly spelled. There was bad spelling, terrible grammar. It didn't really make any sense. Generative AI has changed that. Now the attackers are able to put together really compelling email stories within that using generative AI. The other piece is around mass automation. The whole thing with AI is you can build amazing tools. Now, if you think about it in a business environment, when you're deploying AI into a business, what do organizations do? They first build a case for it. Once they've built the case, they then lay out what the process is going to be. Once they've laid out the process, they look at what the potential problems are. Once they have the potential problems and they handle that, they'll then run a little pilot in a segregated testing. And then months down the line, they'll deploy this amazing piece of AI, and it'll probably still be valid and the business will benefit. What do the attackers do? There's a new feature in some piece of AI, or there's a whole bunch of dark web GPTs and you know, bad, corrupt or dangerous AIs that are out there. As soon as a new capability is available, what do the attackers do? They take it, they shove it into their attack framework, and they run with it, and they deploy it immediately. People see new things coming, and they don't really know how to respond, and then they're effective, and then everybody's catching up to try and catch on. You know, the attackers aren't they're not confined by morals. They're not confined by planning. They just go. And with AI now, an attacker may have been able to target 10, maybe 15, 20 businesses in a day. They can now target hundreds at the same time, automatically with no intervention. You now only get involved once that initial access has been gained, and then they can do their searches from there. And it's made that's why cybercrime, if it was a country, would have the third biggest GDP in the world. 2025 damage is going to be around $10 trillion globally from cybercrime. Like, it's frightening. It's the US, China, cybercrime as the three biggest generators of revenue in the world.
No, that's absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, my next question was going to be, can you give us some facts and figures there? But I mean, $10 trillion is just absolutely mind-blowing. And I mean, that's probably made up of a lot of very small batches, $10,000, $100,000, $1 million here. But then obviously some big ones in the billions of dollars, and the ones that you see on the face of the Financial Times. So they go in for small, medium, large, micro, established businesses, brand new businesses as well. They generally don't discriminate. And I mean, it seems to be gathering pace here. How do you keep up with the charge of these criminals?
So firstly, on the point of these attacks, the $10 trillion, that comes from reported incidents, from known incidents. We know from the dark web channels and forums that our teams are involved and are constantly looking at, that there are hundreds of businesses being compromised on a daily basis that are not reported. We also know, like, for example, in the UK, if a loss is under £10,000, it's filed for reference purposes, and ultimately then if it comes about in the same piece and accidentally you find out who the person was, great. But there's just not enough capacity to chase it. So if it's under 10 grand, it gets reported and set aside. And if they all build up, it's exactly the same thing. Maybe more can be done and they can allocate resources to it. We see so many where attacks are 11,000 euros or various other currencies. And whatever happens, and if you convert it back, it drops just below that 10 grand level. It's not by accident. That's absolutely not by accident. I mean, if you're able to get 5, 10, 20 businesses a week to pay you just under £10,000, you've got a viable business there. That's putting the kids through private school, no doubt. So, you know, in terms of addressing it, what we do is get really boring. Cybersecurity has this air of mystery, and like, it's cool, and we see the movies, and you got the guys in the back of the van with their hoodies on, typing away, punching, seeing green screens all over the place. That's not what happens. You know, the way we help defend it is we do the most practical, boring stuff every single day with monotonous regularity. We implement and know what good looks like. So that as soon as there's an anomaly, when there's a change, when behavior changes, when logins change, when activity changes, the whole thing is when it's out of the ordinary, we then investigate, stop, and kick it out. You know, it's the key thing. If you're looking at the front door of a jewelry shop every single day, you'll know when someone's walking up. If they have a machete in their hand, they're probably not coming to buy a diamond ring. But again, you need that visibility. So we get visibility at the perimeter so that we stop things from getting inside.
Mm, mm. No, that's really good. And I think the basics will always be the basics. It's easy to have shiny object syndrome and chase all the nice to haves and all that type of stuff. But I mean, the basics, the password protection, following the standard operating procedures, all of that has a place, because that is how you're going to thwart the criminals as well. Because you literally, I remember there was a saying in Gauteng, is that you just need to have better security than your neighbor, and the criminals will go and rob your neighbor's house, not you. So if you're just doing the basics right and have slightly better stuff and just keep your wits about you, I think the criminals can go and look elsewhere. It doesn't say that you're immune from what's going on around you, but you'll make it slightly harder for them, or they'll just ignore you until they come around next time. But it doesn't mean you, just because you did it right this week, that next week nothing's going to happen.
Absolutely, because the attack has evolved. I think that's really the critical piece. Yeah, we lean back to the thing that these are fast moving organizations, these criminal networks, right? They need to move on. They need to get to the next piece. So if you have the controls in place for that exact reason, they'll come in, they'll go, you know, we can, like, you can tell that this hashed password, this organization is using 16 character passwords. They're not identical. They're not the same. Clearly using a password manager or whatever it is to manage these things, to break that is quite difficult. So sure, let us try and trick the human. If tricking the human is much easier than breaking into a system. But if we're providing adequate training for them to, and the people, and our people know what it is that's correct, that way you have another step up. When they are tricked and access is granted, they get in some or other way. Like, we have controls in place. For example, if you don't have anybody that works in Italy or in Norway, then we just will not allow anyone to log in from Italy or Norway. Like, it's really a lot of basic controls that are consistently applied across those five areas of digital risk to keep you secure.
No, that's a great example. I mean, it's such a simple thing and quite obvious, just to create the correct boundaries for your staff to log in. And talking about countries, you're currently focused on growing the UK side for J2 software. Tell me how you're driving that strategy and maybe some of the success stories that you've had.
So we launched in South Africa, and we're in the process. Our vision, whatever the term is you want to use, is to build a global cybersecurity focused services business with our roots in South Africa. Our 24/7 SOC is based out of our South African operation. And our first major geographic expansion, has been to the UK, where I'm now driving, customer adoption, and essentially creating great security for UK businesses, and from our island, rest of Europe. We're looking to expand Australia thereafter. One of the key items for me has been through networking, to create brand awareness, having these sorts of discussions where we talk about cybersecurity, because it doesn't matter where in the world you are, people who are running and managing business and departments that are not in, they are not a bank. They have this false understanding of what security needs to be, and it's giving that awareness. So we've got some great partnerships that we've done here. And the other side of it is just doing the work, knocking on the doors. You know, like old, it feels sometimes like old school door to door vacuum cleaner sales. Just speaking, telling people how wonderful our service is, and letting them, and explaining where it is they're having gaps, identifying those. And it's been a great journey so far. We're having some great success. We've gotten in with a whole lot of associations and groups now, which has really been fortunate. And of course, I've been leveraging members of the LECA network to help me. And other networks that I'm involved in, speaking to like-minded people, spreading the message, and using our customers that we have here, in the UK. Now we're up to 40 We have 40 customers in the UK. Globally, we service over 700 customers on 5 continents. There's just on 40 here in the UK now. And then we leverage the work we do with them for them to refer us on outside of that. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on all at the same time. But fortunately, we have a phenomenal team that makes sure we get stuff done every day. I think that's the key thing for us.
Awesome, John. I love that and wish you all the best with that. And now talking about the Right Place podcast, here we believe that your right place is at the intersection of your roles, your relationships, and environment. So I just want to focus on that a bit more. You've worn many hats during your career: strategist, game changer, playmaker. What role has surprised you the most on your journey?
Well, it's the fact that there's no such thing as one potential role as you're building out a business. I'd say over the years, the biggest problems we had in the business all happened here, all inside my head. Some of the biggest problems we had were things that never actually materialized, and they were all made up. Getting through these things is what gets you to, you'd say, the right place. And for me, it's understanding that one of the epiphany moment for me was realizing that I actually can't do everything. And handing off responsibility within the business, and this is going back a number of years now, and it's still vivid in my memory. Releasing some of the control and anxiety around that, it was something that was a real challenge to get over. Like, I can't be the one that is creating and authorizing every payment in the business anymore. I can't be the one that has knowledge of absolutely every little thing that's going on across the business, because that way we would never be able to scale.
Excellent, John. I mean that comes with maturity as well, and over time. And I mean, you've had an up and down career, as you've told me. You've also had some health challenges over the years that have built your resilience. Tell me about those and how you've had to navigate that in order to keep the company alive, but also keep yourself alive at the same time.
Life has this amazing way of humbling you at various stages and challenging you. I think that's the key thing. The reason I am so driven on the resilience message is I believe that you know, with the right mindset, you need some support, you can get through pretty much everything. It's focusing on that end game. So when I was younger, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer relatively young. Had very little time to process it. Had surgery, had some treatment. That was all. Went through that. Came through that relatively unscathed, if you call a major surgery relatively unscathed. But got to a little while later, we had a son who unfortunately had congenital pneumonia, and we lost him. We named him after my dad, and he passed away shortly, not long, few weeks after birth. That was the worst experience of my life. And then obviously we get through to starting the business. J2's started. There's a whole load of stress, and shortly after launch, I have a recurrence of the cancer in my para-aortic lymph glands. Now, what I've realized is you only learn terms like para-aortic lymph glands if you're going to be a doctor or there's something wrong with them. So ultimately, that led to almost a year of chemotherapy. There was terrible times where at one weekend I lost over 7 kilos over a weekend. There's things that I've learned about my body and what can happen to it that you don't necessarily want anyone to know. That was chemotherapy through to radiation. And at that time, I was sitting in chemo rooms. I had between 3 and 4 hour chemotherapy. My veins all collapsed. I had to get a port put in, various other items with there. But I would sit in this room and I didn't have time to mope. J2 was a new business. I had to work. There was only 2 or 3 of us at the time. So I was sitting there with my laptop, answering mails, trying to close deals, setting up meetings for the weeks I wouldn't be on chemo. So, you know, at the end of the day, a positive attitude, great doctors, and a great support with my wife pulled me through all of those things, even the darkest times. You have the ability to survive. The human mind is absolutely the most powerful weapon there is, and you have to be resilient. You can't focus on the negatives that's happening now or there or blame somebody else. It's all up to us and how we then respond to those that keeps you going.
No, exactly, John. And I mean, you need good people around you to come alongside and just support you and keep encouraging you. And talking about these relationships around you, what are some of the people that you are connecting with deliberately to surround yourself with, to encourage you and to keep John and J2 Software thriving in 2025?
So I obviously have a lot of interactions with a senior management team within the business, and we, you know, trying to continue to drive the same picture, keeping us all aligned. I have several podcasts and books and items that I'm continually reading and learning from. Some of them I listen to absolutely everything and binge listen end to end. Others I know within 30 minutes is not the right fit, and that's the end of that. And then I also like to spend a lot of time speaking to other business owners, people who are building things. I love to also share my experiences through the builds within these, the pieces we're encountering, because everyone's at a different stage, right? So I can't believe we've been doing this business for almost 20 years. Like, I don't feel like I'm old enough to have been in this business for 20 years. And it is, you know, it's going through those stories and understanding them and speaking to other business owners has been phenomenal. And the risk we took, I look back at it now and it was absolutely bonkers, but so exciting. And now being essentially in another startup, doing the same thing almost 19 years later in another country on another continent, it's what absolutely drives me. This is the real fun, but getting the stuff set up, working through these items. I mean, my youngest daughter, she was 2 months old when J2 was launched. I think back about it now, and I'm like, being older and apparently wiser, if you ask my wife, I haven't grown up yet, but that's fine. But if, you know, if I look back now, I'm going, you put all, like, we've put it all on the line with a two month old daughter at home. It's, yeah. So I suppose one of the things that also drives me is you got to make sure that you don't have a choice but to succeed. Like, you cannot not succeed. We've had in the years, I think it was twice, I had to have great words with our auditors who said we were potentially insolvent. I told them we weren't, and the audit was on books from months before. And you know, there's so much that has gone on in this journey, and then having those conversations with other business owners is it's a pleasure and a joy, and I often learn something new, and it's the most basic thing from just basic conversations with like-minded people.
No, amazing, John. And I mean, I think that comes now hand in hand with my next question, which is on your word for 2025, which is get stuff done. And you're definitely a go-getter. You leave no stone unturned. You are relentless. You're resilient. Tell me about how that is working in 2025 so far.
So, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, get stuff done. It's the phrase we use in Polite Company, because that S in get stuff done is not necessarily stuff. But ultimately, when things get really difficult, I need to focus on getting stuff done, because I am also prone to procrastination. I'd say I could be level 3000 procrastinator, like never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. But then remembering to get stuff done allows you to execute. When I start drifting, that's when I get called back by those that are closest to me. Sales director in South Africa actually pointed this out probably 3 or 4 months ago, going like, it's taking too long to get things done. We're not executing. And called me out on it. And I was like, okay, so now we have to and brought me back in line. So for me, as soon as we can pull back that get, you know, to get stuff done, it helps get through the times of overwhelm. Because there are periods when there seems like there's 6 million things to do, and then prioritizing becomes difficult because then the procrastination sits in, the fear of not doing anything fits in, and then you start beating yourself up, and then you start spiraling down. You're like, whoa, I got to get stuff done. Like, let's do 1, 2, 3, and next thing, the task list just disappears. So yeah, it seems to be working when I remember it, and it's a constant work in progress. Like, it really is. So nothing is perfect, and it is a grind. It's hard work, but we've got to put the work in if we want the results.
No, 100%, John. I mean, I 100% agree with you in terms of putting the work in. I mean, I can also be a master procrastinator. I sometimes say, no, but I'll just leave it to the side. I'll get to it. I like working under pressure. And then out of the blue, the pressure just hits you like a ton of bricks, and you've got to make magic happen and call in a few miracles. And it's all self-inflicted. I mean, you knew this was coming. You knew you were under a tidal wave. Now, John, talking about your right place, tell me about what that feels like in 2025.
So knowing your podcast, knowing this question was coming, I was pondering it. It sounds like I've given such deep thought. But ultimately, you know, I have been thinking about it. And to be in the, if I'm in the right place, I have to be, because this is where I am. It's the place that I have chosen to be. It's the place that I have got myself to. If I don't, if it isn't the right place, I wouldn't be here. Like, you know, a lot of thought goes into these items, and sometimes you just act and you respond on the way. So am I where I was thought I was going to be today? Probably not. But is it the right place? Absolutely, because this is where I've got to. Things have changed, got to be dynamic, got to flow, move through, and ultimately that then puts you in the place that you're at. And for me right now, I believe this is the right place. Is it the best place? I think it's the best place I can be in today. Tomorrow, it could be somewhere else. It could be a little bit further along the journey. But you know, ultimately, I am in the right place. This is the right place because this is where I have led myself to be.
I love that answer, John, and I love the thought that you put into it. And it's so true that wherever you are right now is the right place. And it might not be the perfect place, it might not be the best place, but it's the place that you can move forward from, and you can choose your roles, your relationships, your environments. You can influence them, you can improve them, and that will take you to a better place or a more right place. But wherever you are right now, that seems to be the right place. And now, John, lastly, as we wrap up the podcast, John, you're a member of the Lacquer Network, like myself. Tell me why you joined and what has been your experience so far?
Well, also a founding member. Going back, I started seeing some of the posts going around, and I really resonate with the post when Nick said, when he goes, South Africa's best export is its people. Like, that's absolutely is absolutely true. I saw more of this, and then figured, knowing how South Africans work, how they operate, how they always seem to want to help each other and those around them, I thought to myself, if I have to be honest, I definitely didn't want to miss out, John. So there was FOMO involved in that as well. Like, what if I don't do this and it is what I think it's going to be? That's just mad. So I ended up getting involved. Went It's something that I always love to say. I love to say that like networking is a full contact sport, right? So you've got to be 100% in it. So that means getting involved, helping, answering questions, passing on referrals, speaking to people, meeting people. And I've met so many great people since being part of the has it led to business for us? Absolutely. We've accidentally, by as a byproduct, brought on new customers. We've also utilized the services of other people in the network just by understanding what else is available out there and things that have, and it's really helped our business and we continue to do so. So yeah, the Lacquer Network for me has been an absolute win. Met some great people, been to some great events. Who would have thought I went to go watch Lamborghinis racing around a racetrack through the network? Like it's just, it really is inspiring. It's motivational. And I mean, you know it. You're doing this every day. It's just, it is when you're feeling like things are getting a bit rough, have a chat to some of the people in the network. It lifts you up. They'll motivate you. And if you need something, there's always somebody who knows the right person to connect you to. And yeah, that has been phenomenal for me.
Excellent, John. I love that answer, and I love that I can hear the passion and I can hear the enthusiasm for the network there. And I mean, it's not a sales network. What I keep telling people is, it's not for you to sell. It's for you to learn. It's for you to connect with other people, and just have conversations. And conversations turn into relationships. Relationships might just be you might just meet your best friend, your new best friend for the next 20 years, or you might meet an investor or a partner or a collaborator, especially in the IT space, which is so massive nowadays. So I always encourage people, guys, just approach us with an open mind, with a giving heart, and answer that question, how can I help you? And you'll start having the right conversations, which will definitely help you scale up your business over time.
Absolutely. And I've seen exactly that. That's especially why I said we've ended up getting customers added to our books as a byproduct of how good that it was. Just sort of that was like an added advantage that just came out of nowhere. I've also started, I've been able to take my first, to make my first sort of investment outside of the primary business, through things I've learned from the context that I've learned within the network. And I have one of my other goals for this year is people that I tell people, I'm like, I want them to have a look, go through my LinkedIn profile, see who I interact with, who I'm connected with. And if there's some way that they think I can help them, ask me. Because that for me is another goal. This year's target was to get, is to get our customer base in the UK up to 60 customers, and for me to help as many people as possible through introductions, assistance, guidance, answering questions, trying to demystify whatever it is. And that really has, it's taking us through. I mean, before we know it, it'll be 2026. And I don't want it to be New Year's Eve and me looking back going, and have I helped enough people this year? And if that answer is no, like then I would have failed this year.
No, that's a great mission, John, and I wish you all the best with that. John, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you today. I really appreciate your time and your insights, especially on the cybersecurity side. If people want to connect with you and learn more about J2 software, where's the best place to do that?
So what I would suggest is stick J2 software into Google, and you'll see us pop up hopefully all over the place. And our web and SEO people are definitely doing a good job there, I think. And outside of that, find me on LinkedIn. I'm relatively active on LinkedIn. I try and get to all of the messages that I receive on there as well. Connect, follow, connect with me. Drop me a message, and if there's then that way, if there's anything I can help with, I'm merely a couple of messages away. I think LinkedIn is probably the place I'm most active outside of in person. If you're near and about London, I have been known to favor an in-person meeting, and I might say let's meet for coffee. But I usually mispronounce coffee as a beer. So yeah, just I'd love to speak to more people. That's really my big thing. One of the lines I normally use in a networking event is like they ask you what is you looking for, and I'm like, I just want to speak to more people because I've got almost no friends. So please chat to me, connect. Let's talk some more, and yeah, let's get to know each other.
Awesome, John. Thank you so much. That was really fun. John, thank you for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Please connect with John. Please follow J2 Software. Find John on LinkedIn. Please like and follow and subscribe to The Right Place podcast. And we will see you again next time at The Right Place. Cheers.